In the Iliad, old Homer says, to speak his thoughts is every free man's right in peace and war, in council and in fight. But one might ask, what about in college and university? And what about students and faculty? Do they all have the right to speak their thoughts? That is the base. The answer, from the point of view of Greg Lukianoff and the organization he heads, the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, the answer is yes, indeed, they have that right. Mm-hmm. But FIRE, which is the acronym mm-hmm. for the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, has found hundreds and hundreds of instances mm-hmm. in which the right of free speech is simply denied to students mm-hmm. and often to faculty.
Absolutely. Before being involved with FIRE, I knew that there was a problem on college campuses, certainly going back to the Water Buffalo incident, certainly to the rise of speech codes in the 80s and 90s.
Some people are wondering, the Water Buffalo incident? We will come to that shortly.
Absolutely.
Because it's the incident that generated the invention of the organization
Absolutely.
That you are now heading.
Absolutely. The I had no idea how bad it was on college campuses, but the kind of things that can get you in trouble on the modern college campus are the kind of things that, you know, a good Brooklynite, a good Chicagoan wouldn't even bat an eye at. Even innocuous speech seems capable of getting in trouble on campuses these days.
It's because the cult of political correctness began mm-hmm. to hang as if a miasma over the American campus. Mm-hmm. And that produced all sorts of problems, one of which is well illustrated by the Water Buffalo incident. Mm-hmm. We go to 1993, I think. Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Campus of the University of Pennsylvania mm-hmm. in Philadelphia.
Right. An entire dormitory was woken up by an African-American mm-hmm. sorority sisters group that decided to serenade, in other words, shout songs at the at the dormitory, and woke them up at something like 3 or 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning. And Jacobowitz, a Jewish student, yelled out, "Go home, you water buffaloes." Now, I've never heard water buffalo being a racial slur before, and mm-hmm. apparently it's related to the idea of behemoth, which in Hebrew is like a yak, and it means annoying
he
person.
He wasn't Israeli, was he?
He wasn't, but he was from.
He had spent time in Israel, or
right?
Something.
Absolutely, and. The university wanted to try out its shiny new speech code, so they brought him up on charges. And really, the main ally that he had in that fight was a professor who taught 18th century theories on liberty, Professor Alan Charles Kors, who went to bat entirely for Eden, and was faced with real serious university corruption to try to.
What was in the speech code? That was the time when speech codes were being invented and mm-hmm. put in place all over the country. Mm-hmm. For example, Donna Shalala, before she went to serve in Clinton's cabinet, uh-huh. was the president of the University of Wisconsin mm-hmm. system, and she presided over
yes.
the development and then the imposition of a vast speech code, which mm-hmm. violated rights in many particulars. What was in the University of Pennsylvania's
University
speech
of Pennsylvania, I think it was something about their language was something about forbidding language that demeans or offends. Mm-hmm. What actually it said, I'm not as familiar with because a court case didn't develop from it. Now, the Donna Shalala case, that was University of Wisconsin Post, which actually generated an opinion in 1991, I believe, which was based on a theory by Richard Delgado to take, who's a pioneer, if you will, of speech code, someone I debated at Williams a couple of years ago. His theory was that that offensive speech fit within the quote-unquote fighting words exception. Fighting words exception, you know, if people like me and Nadine Strossen all agree that this is pretty much a dead doctrine. But creative law school professors who wanted to come up with a rationale for punishing protected speech fell on this old doctrine where a protester had called a policeman a fascist, and the Supreme Court upheld his conviction in 1942. The Supreme Court hasn't upheld a conviction on anything like that in years. It's very clear that the fighting words doctrine, if it's alive at all, is extremely weak. But ironically, in the 80s and 90s, you have professors who probably would absolutely fight for a student or professor's right to call a cop mm-hmm. a fascist are suddenly reviving the old fighting words doctrine in order to punish speech that they dislike. It's very short-sighted.
What happened to this fellow at the University of Pennsylvania?
If it hadn't been for Alan Charles Kors, he probably would have been kicked out, in my opinion.
They did suspend him or something originally, didn't they?
They did punish him, and they pulled out all the stops. Because as soon as the country's attention started to be focused on Penn, initially Penn's response was to dig in its heels,
yeah.
which is a response that we see sometimes. And if it hadn't been for ongoing pressure, and who knows what would have
happened. And then Alan Kors and his old friend and partner Harvey Silverglate. Mm-hmm. Interestingly, Kors, rather a conservative person politically, mm-hmm. Silverglate, a left-winger, a liberal, and a big figure in ACLU, but they shared the same view about the necessity for freedom on campus, and they began examining what's happening on campuses around the country, and they found hundreds of violations.
Absolutely. And they wrote a book called The Shadow University.
And came on this program to discuss it.
Absolutely, which was published in 1998. After they published The Shadow University, they received so many calls for assistance that they realized they had to start an organization, or at least that it would behoove them to. And I joined FIRE in 2001, and again, I had no idea how bad it was on campus. I knew there was a problem. I didn't realize how serious it had gotten and how bizarre the situation could be.
You joined FIRE in 2001, and it's the moment for full disclosure, and I joined it too. Mm-hmm. That is to say, I was invited onto the board.
Mm-hmm.
And though I haven't been a terribly strong contributor in terms of ideas, I am a strong backer of what they do, and I show up whenever I can, which isn't too often when there are board meetings. But I think it's a very significant organization and of essential position in the continuing struggle to make American education not only effective as a system of education, but also to make it responsible in terms of its citizenly duties.
Mm-hmm.
And we want to talk about some of the cases, some of the main cases you've had,
mm-hmm.
and some of the ongoing cases that you're protesting even now.
Mm-hmm.
But that leads to this basic question. What is the basic modus operandi for FIRE?
Mm-hmm.
What do? You don't go to court.
No, we don't. We're not a litigation group at all. I mean, I'm a
trained, so you are a lawyer.
I'm a trained attorney. I'm a constitutionally specialized attorney. That's what I went to law school to do, free speech law. But our approach is some people consider quite novel, but I think it's actually going back to sort of days before people relied on the law as much as they do today, which is that when we find about a violation, we write the university and we say, we explain our understanding of the facts, give them an opportunity to correct us on the facts, explain the law as it applies, but also explain the philosophy of why this is a bad idea to censor this particular person or this particular group or this particular professor.
But where do you get your clout? Is it just by an appeal to reason, or is it also by a gentle warning that if you don't kind of straighten this thing out, we're going to have to go public?
We'll take it public. That's exactly. Some universities, I think, do the right thing just because it hadn't occurred to them. And I genuinely believe there are some very good-hearted people who are just making mistakes in some cases. In other cases, they have to be battered in the nose and in the media before they realize they've done something wrong.
What's a case in the history of the organization where they made a mistake but really wanted to do the right thing and then did the right thing when the whole issue was analyzed for them by FIRE?
Central Michigan University.
What happened there?
That was right after 9/11. RA went to a bunch of students who had pictures of Osama bin Laden in the crosshairs, flags, eagles, a lot of patriotic displays, and a lot of them really angry at Osama bin Laden. An RA demanded that they take them down.
RA research assistant?
Resident assistant.
Resident assistant, yeah.
Demanded that they take them down because students might find them offensive. This is kind of remarkable because people have to think back to, you know, the wake of September 11th. Who wasn't upset? Who wasn't angry? And certainly you can't expect 19-year-olds not to be angry. And this is, you know, pretty tame. And
was the resident assistant backed up by his supervisor?
He was initially. It was backed up by the resident director. But when we wrote the university, the president of the university contacted us, and we consulted with him one-on-one, and they undid the foolish decision.
That reminds me of a very similar case which has popped recently and which I think you are still dealing on. The one just a little bit up the road in Milwaukee at Marquette University.
Oh, Marquette University. Now, that one is actually still ongoing, and I just, you can't make this stuff up. You know, to paraphrase Mark Twain, you know, of course the truth is...
this is just a matter of a sign on an office door.
Uh-huh, absolutely. As the sign just said, "As Americans, we must always remember that we all have a common enemy, an enemy that is dangerous, powerful, and relentless. I refer, of course, to the federal government." That's a Dave Barry quote. Dave Barry is probably the Norman Rockwell of political commentary.
Mm-hmm.
And an administrator demanded...
Who posted it?
A PhD student who had an office.
Yeah.
And it's, as you know, from universities, it's tradition. It's pretty time-honored
tradition.
Put things
up on the door,
put things up on your door. And the administrator took it down. His rationale was that it was patently offensive. Now, if you're a lawyer, or even if you're not, you probably know that patently offensive, as far as the law is concerned, refers to hardcore obscenity. It's and the idea that
This
that
just
quote.
sounds like a little bit of libertarian irony.
Absolutely. I mean,
No more than that.
it's a hysterical overreaction on the part of the university, and they thought that they made two arguments that hot dog they had their way out of it. One of them was that, well, we didn't know it was Dave Barry, and that's just terrific. So it makes it somehow more offensive if you don't know it's Dave Barry. And the other one was that university doors are not quote unquote free speech zones.
That means that everything posted on every door, at least in that department, it's the philosophy department, isn't it?
Philosophy
Must be
department.
taken down, but they haven't done that either.
No, it's a viewpoint discrimination right down to its core.
So you wrote a letter to the president and others at Marquette. What response have you had?
They never responded, and one of the things that they did, and we've just seen this tactic too often, as soon as they start getting calls from the media, they said that they already sent us a letter, and we haven't received a letter. And apparently, they sent it to the media. Of course, when we get the letter, the postmark is many days after we took the case public, so we're a little bit skeptical that they actually sent it to us before we took it
What does
public.
the letter say?
The letter says that's when they made the argument that they didn't know it was Dave Barry and that it had been resolved internally. We talked to the student. It had not been resolved internally. In fact, nobody had spoken to him. So we only took this case public maybe 6 or 7 days ago.
Any further reaction?
They're getting a beating from the media at the moment because this is
From the
frank.
local press as well, up in Milwaukee?
Yes, because this is just stupid. And Dave Barry is having a field day with this. Dave Barry fans everywhere are having a
Yeah.
field day with this.
Well, we are heard in Milwaukee by thousands and thousands of people. Anyone up there who is in on this case and wants to say something about it, we look forward to hearing from you later in the second hour. Right now, I look forward to continued conversation with Greg Lukianoff. I plant this basic question. Thinking in terms of social history and social forces, what accounts for this new burden of political correctness violating free speech rights in American higher education? Or was it always the case? And is it only that just now an organization like yours has become aware of it and has sort of given it fuller publicity, fuller ventilation? We return directly to Greg Lukianoff, president of the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, after these words. And my special guest for the evening is Greg Lukianoff, who is the president of the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education. He's also a regular columnist for the Daily Journal of Los Angeles and San Francisco, and writes for lots of other publications about, in the main, the kinds of issues we are discussing tonight. I was raising a general question of social history. Was it ever thus on the American campus, but we've only become more aware of it and only finally begun to vigilantly police this sort of thing recently through organizations like this and the NAS, National Association of Scholars? Or was there a new epidemic of this attempt, this style of thought control in American academic life that sort of emerged a few decades ago?
Well, it would be wrong to say that there was ever really a truly perfect time for free speech on campus. I sometimes like to joke that there was maybe a week in 1977 in between after the free speech movement and before the rise of political correctness where speech was perfectly free on campus. But certainly there was a new movement starting in the 1980s that was somewhat distinct from previous movements in suppression on campus that usually was related more to discipline and ideas of imposing morality more than in the 1950s, that there was a value in flat out repression of offensive ideas. And this was something that was pioneered by people like Mary Matsuda, Richard Delgado, Catherine MacKinnon. And there was the rise of the speech goes in the 1980s. Now, one of the amazing things is our research, and we're not alone in this, there's been other law review articles written about this, that from 1989 to 1995, there was pretty much no less than five decisions making it extremely clear that at least at public colleges, and in one case at my alma mater, Stanford, that even at a private college, speech codes were a violation of the law or unconstitutional. Amazingly, despite that, the number of speech codes on campuses have actually increased, not decreased. So,
Even to the present moment.
even to the present moment, we're just about to come up with a report in about a week or two on the state of speech codes from 2005 to 2006. And of 330 that we evaluated, the overwhelming majority of them maintained, in many cases, laughably unconstitutional or ridiculous speech codes. And there's a reason why we've had the rise of speech codes that isn't just related to ideology. Certainly, there is a really strong belief that people have a right not to be offended, that hate speech is not protected speech, and that's grown over the past couple decades. That wasn't really so much around in the 1960s, but there is also this tremendous expansion of university bureaucracy. And I think that for me, it's particularly galling that when the average American household makes $43,000 a year, that places like Harvard cost $50,000 a year, and you're paying for the additional staff in order to police your thoughts, police your speech,
And
etc.
administrators at any level, from president to dean to deanlet to what have you, basically want to have an environment in which you don't make large waves. Therefore, if anybody complains, they're quite likely to pursue the complaint and try to squelch the person being complained against. I know of a wonderful case from years ago. I don't know that fire intervened. It probably didn't. And I forget the name of this famous historian at Harvard. His wife is also very well established, and you will remember his name probably. An historian who gave a course on the West, was it, or was it on American Indian history? I don't know. There were complaints from some of his students. This is a senior professor with full tenure and rich in honors. Some of his students complained that he spoke of Indians rather than Native Americans. And they went to the administration about it. And the then president of Harvard, advised by who knows who else, finally rendered the judgment that he would no longer be allowed to teach that course.
Oh my. That is actually somewhat before our time, but it doesn't surprise me
Yeah.
a little bit, the sort of inanity that you see on college campuses. And the sad thing is, in some cases, it can ruin people's careers. This can be very serious
Yes, if
stuff.
you're a junior person without tenure, it can indeed.
Absolutely. And one of the things, one of the other forces that I think gets overlooked, and it's related to the idea of bureaucracy, is liability. And that comes from sexual harassment lawsuits, etc., where the concept of what it means to harass actually transmogrifies in the same thing as being offended.
Oh, that leads to a wonderful realm, a wonderful area. And I know you got a case going or that you're looking at right now, which involves this. A number of years ago, many of the colleges and universities developed sort of dating codes, I
Oh
guess what
my,
we'd have to
yeah.
call them, making clear that if you touch somebody without being first asking permission, as a guy might put his arm around a young woman or hold her hand tentatively, that could be viewed as sort of sexual assault. And so they wrote codes specifying point by point by point what was supposed to be done. If you kiss somebody, then if your hands begin to wander, before you can let them wander, we have to get permission for the kiss. Then you have to ask about, can I put my hand here? May I put it there? Etc. And at Oberlin, they were living by that. It must have driven everybody crazy. I think Oberlin finally abandoned it. Did fire help them to abandon it?
That was a little bit before our time. That actually
But
existed.
you've got a case like that right
Yes,
now
we do.
concerning Gettysburg College,
Gettysburg
is it?
College in Pennsylvania, Gettysburg, where the Battle of Gettysburg was fought. And I just have to read from the policy.
Please
It's
do,
quite
yes.
remarkable. Well, first of all, Gettysburg is a private college, but they do promise their students that they enjoy the same rights that other citizens enjoy. That's a direct quote. But the sexual misconduct policy says that that you can't have unconsensual sexual conduct. And of course, if consent, that's perfectly fine.
And
However, how they define it.
reaching for a hand to hold it is sexual conduct.
Well, this is the way they write it. The act of willingly and verbally agreeing to, for example, by stating yes to engage in specific sexual conduct. If either person at any point in a sexual encounter does not give continuing and active consent, all sexual conduct must cease, even if consent was given earlier. And this is what makes it so absurd. The policy's broad definition of sexual interaction includes not only sex, but also brushing, touching, grabbing, pinching, patting, hugging, and kissing. Who on earth hug somebody and ask for continuing ongoing consent? And it's one of the things we've been trying to explain to Gettysburg. On the face of it, your policy makes absolutely everybody at Gettysburg College guilty of sexual misconduct. Do you really want that? Don't you see that that's a formula for abuse?
You've written to them about it.
Yes.
How have the administration at Gettysburg responded?
With some vague assurances that they're going to be reviewing the policy, and they've continued to get battered in the press by. I had an article in the Boston. I had an article in the in a Philadelphia
So one
paper
cost
about
they pay is ridicule.
it. Yes.
Public
Yep.
ridicule.
Kathy Young did an article about it. There was just an article in a paper in Colorado about it. The university. I'm quite confident that they, and I know from inside sources that they are actually currently rewriting their code to make it hopefully sane.
Of course, we're taught by an old American blues tune that there are dangers here. That blues tune is "Don't You Touch My Thigh," because if you touch my thigh, you're going to go too high. But this isn't about touching thighs; it's about linking pinkies.
Yeah, exactly. And it's one of these things where having there's nothing wrong with having a sane sexual
No.
misconduct policy. But you don't want to turn everybody into criminals on campus, because I mean, if you find someone, if you create this overbroad standard by which everybody is guilty of sexual misconduct, that leaves it up to the arbitrary whim of administrators to decide who they want to kick out and who they don't.
It's madness, but it has its comical aspects, has it
Absolutely.
not? We are going to pause for a quick update on the news and then directly back. We are talking about the works and the achievements of the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education with its president, Greg Lukianoff. We will return to looking at some of the cases and some of the even more serious, rather than merely amusing, cases that you've got on your agenda right now. Columbia University is a good
It is a serious
case in
one, yeah.
point. We'll talk about that shortly. But first, I think we need to do sort of a legal primer.
Sure.
I'm going to read, after all, I asked you to put on your lawyer's hat right now, Greg, and I'm going to read the First Amendment to the United States Constitution. Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, or abridging the freedom of speech or of the press, or of the right of the people peaceably to assemble and to petition the government for a redress of grievances. But it's Congress shall make no law. Now you're not running a close surveillance of Congress. You're surveilling what's happening on the campuses of America. So where's the connection?
Well, it's a long
What gives you or anybody else the right to say this is illegal?
Right. It's a long historical path, and it goes back to right after the Civil War. When the First Amendment was passed, absolutely, it only bound the federal government. There was some debate in the 19th century whether or not that was actually the case, and it was more expansive. But essentially, most legal scholars agree that by its own language, it really wasn't binding on states, and that states could restrict free speech as they saw fit.
So certainly college institutions and
Right.
private ones
Right.
could do the same, could they not?
Right. So in the after the Civil War, however, but partially due to the disaster of pure state rights, the 14th Amendment was passed, which applied all of the which eventually would be fine to apply. It's actually a pretty complicated history between 1865 and 1925, but eventually, weirdly through the due process clause of the 14th Amendment, the Supreme Court applied the protections of the First Amendment to state institutions, which include public colleges, because they are state institutions. So all state institutions are bound by the First Amendment.
So that now makes the University of Illinois subject to the First Amendment,
Right.
but it doesn't make the place where I've worked for so many years,
Right.
the University of Chicago,
Right.
similarly subject, does it?
Absolutely. It doesn't apply to them in that way. However, most universities that are taken seriously, most private universities, have extensive promises of free speech in their policies, and they have a contractual obligation to live up to those promises. And sometimes I think people don't really take this theory as seriously as they should. But think about Harvard. Harvard has something like a $26 billion endowment. They raise this much money in part by representing themselves as a citadel of free speech. People give to Harvard, give billions of dollars to Harvard. The students pay $50,000 a year in order to go to Harvard, on the
But that didn't
belief.
stop them from telling that history professor, you can't teach
Right.
this course anymore because you called Native Americans Indians.
Right.
That's a violation of their dignity or something.
Yeah, exactly. So, so if you promise free speech and you make that much money, acting like you respect it, you better live up to those promises. And fire holds their feet, to forgive the pun, to the fire on that. You promise free speech, you have to deliver it. And if a private university doesn't want to promise free speech, that is within their right. But good luck getting students to go to that school.
So, in essence, then, on that basis, all American institutions of higher learning are subject to the free speech standard. But surely there are some
There are some exceptions.
who choose not to live by that standard.
BYU is the example that I usually use.
Brigham Young
Brigham Young
University?
University is extraordinarily clear in its
What do they
policies,
do and say?
that you have rights up until it conflicts with our Mormon identity, and they are extremely clear about that, and they're extremely vocal about that. And so I don't think anyone is deceived when they give money to BYU or go to BYU when their policies are
So
excessively
if
clear.
someone stands up in a psychology class, a professor, and says, when you really examine his full career rather closely,
Brigham
Brigham
Young.
Young was something of a tyrant. Probably there was paranoid grandiosity built into his character that would get him fired.
That could potentially get them fired. And it would be, you know, in my opinion, that would be unwise. I think the marketplace of ideas leads to the greatest number of
ideas. Or if
ideas.
You said Joseph Smith was given to hallucinations.
Right. And they could, it would be within their rights to fire. Would it be good thinking? Would it show that they're committed to actual academic freedom or intellectual inquiry? No. But do they have the right to do it if they're not promising free speech to begin with?
Now then, I want to go to Columbia University right after we pause. And there are three or four things wrong at Columbia right now,
right
one of
now.
The great institutions of higher learning in this country. And we'll review that right after we pause for this. And we return to Greg Lukianoff, president of the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education. Columbia University has been taking up a lot of your time and the time of your staff. What's going on up there?
Well, there are no less than three serious situations going on at Columbia University. The first one started a couple weeks ago, where a hockey club got in trouble for using essentially a rude word as a pun on a flyer. The club's team name was the Lions. They used a hackneyed joke, and we've seen this. We actually have photos of this being used even by the student government, saying, "Don't be a pussy, join the hockey club." Students objected to the use of this word, and the idea of someone objecting to sort of a second level swear word in Harlem, in New York City, to me is just mind-boggling. They hear worse things on their way to class every day. But the university de-recognized the hockey club.
Was the complaint from an organized feminist group as such?
It was from a number of different students. It wasn't so much an organized group, but definitely the major argument was that essentially this is offensive to women. Which to me is kind of pushing it, particularly given this is an old joke at the university.
Your basic point, of course, is that free speech may give offense.
Absolutely,
that isn't the standard by which you repress speech.
Absolutely, and it's one of these things that I've said for years. Being offended is what happens when you have your deepest beliefs challenged. But if you make it through 4 years of college without ever being offended, ask for your money back. The idea that people can live in a sanitized bubble of never being offended is neither possible nor desirable. And it's one of these things that, I think that's one of the great things about FIRE is we have staff members from all across the political spectrum.
And you have board members, as I've confessed. I'm a member of the Board of Advisors, and one whom I treasure also on that board is a leading member of the ACLU, namely Nat Hentoff, who's very much a left oriented person politically
and a big fan of fire.
A staunch civil libertarian. He's in there because he's got the ACLU concern.
Well, he's very consistent on freedom of speech.
Quite and so.
He's been a tremendous help when it comes to the Columbia cases. The other case that has made the news an awful lot is that Jim Gilchrist, the head of the Minutemen, the group that polices the border, the volunteer group that polices the border between Mexico and the U.S., had a speech at Columbia. And students actually stormed the stage, and a fight ensued. The stunning thing about it is that when students were questioned about why they, what they were thinking, they showed absolutely no understanding of the basic principles of free speech. One of the things that they argued was that this was not a legitimate point of view, so we exercised our free speech rights in order to shut this person up, which is just completely Orwellian turn of phrase.
Therefore, properly, the administration should have held them to some standard and been punitive about this behavior.
Right, and you don't have a free speech right to shut other people up. And Bollinger's always been President Lee Bollinger's always been, claimed to be a great supporter of free speech.
He's a lawyer who teaches this stuff.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
But he was also the dean of the law school down at during the time of Doe v. Michigan, the very first speech code case, which people seem to overlook all the time.
And they've not acted at all.
To our knowledge, they said some strong things and then did nothing. And the New York Post actually just came up with an article, I think, today, saying calling them to the mat for not doing anything.
Got a very comparable case for you. It seems to have happened on the campus of the University of Washington in Seattle only within the last few days. There was a demonstration in relation to maybe somebody who was speaking or some other event on the campus. There was a demonstration by people who marched onto the campus, just a small number, I gather, carrying signs against abortion rights. That is, they were a pro-life group, so-called. A number of students stopped them and essentially ordered them off the campus and said, "Your kind of opinion isn't wanted here." The administration has so far done nothing about this, though it is in the Seattle Times and Post Intelligencer this very day. Is that a comparable case, would you say?
I would say, and there's definitely one other example that I have to give because it's so outrageous, and it was just in the last 6 months. Northern Kentucky University, and it shows about this completely warped view of free speech and the way it can be abused. A professor at Northern Kentucky University, a public college directly bound by the First Amendment or through the 14th Amendment, she urged her students, in her own words, to quote unquote exercise their free speech rights to destroy a pro-life display. And there was
same thing.
Photographic evidence of her actually destroying this display that the pro-life students had put together. And it's just remarkable that you could actually think that you have a right to that this is complete opposite of what free speech means.
There's yet another problem at Columbia, or rather at its adjunct institution, Teachers College of Columbia, which I think is the worst of all.
Oh yeah, well this is remarkable, and I've been amazed at how thick Columbia has been on understanding it when it seems like everybody outside of the academy understands this. Teachers College has a requirement that students demonstrate their quote unquote commitment to social justice. And then they go on to define social justice by saying that students are expected to recognize social inequalities are often produced and perpetuated through systemic discrimination and justified by societal ideology of merit, social mobility, and individual responsibility. And as I said in my article in the New York Post, I don't think our society is exactly suffering from a scourge of individual
responsibility. So if Shelby Steele came on the campus and gave and talked from his most recent book, or Juan Williams from his similarly recent book, both of which make the same argument, both of them leading black intellectuals and public figures, who say it's time we stop blaming Whitey for everything and we have to take individual initiative to improve our lot, that would be viewed as...
not socially just.
As not socially just. And I suppose the administrators of Teachers College Columbia would feel it's consistent if they banned such speech from their campus.
By their own definition, it wouldn't be social justice, and that would then, and because of the vagueness and overbreath, and also the incredible specificity of what they're saying about social justice, I feel like Teachers College should immediately understand that this is a standard that they should be getting rid of.
But isn't this part of a larger movement known as the Dispositions Movement?
Yes.
Explain what that is.
The Dispositions Movement, a number of universities, including not universities, of accrediting agencies, including the accrediting agency of teachers' colleges and the accrediting agency of social work colleges, have required certain dispositions, quote-unquote dispositions.
It's a wonderful word.
Yeah, and they can get very specific about the political beliefs that you're supposed to have, but also set up incredibly vague and politically loaded standards. Now, I feel like Teachers College would immediately understand what the philosophical problem is with this if someone tried to impose a patriotism requirement or a commitment to individualism.
Which might be a required disposition.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And that's one of the things. It is that to teach someone what their conclusions must be is thought control, not education. And you would think that a university would understand that. Certainly when universities were faced with loyalty oaths in the 1950s, most universities understood that this is inappropriate. We shouldn't be we shouldn't be pledging allegiance to the American way of life.
Now, there are many schools around the country, as far as I understand, who are playing with this dispositions requirement.
Well, the worst example we've seen is Teachers College. Since the National Accrediting Agency of Teacher Education this June actually abandoned its social justice disposition, the first school that we realized had to abandon this was Teachers College, because Teachers College is pretty much the number one leading leg.
Who's in charge? Is that Bollinger or is that somebody else?
Bollinger is definitely the person we're talking to the most, and he's trying to sort of shift the blame on.
But there's a special president of Teachers College as well.
Yes, there is Furman.
I'm not sure who it is, but how have they responded?
They sent a letter that was clearly cut and pasted together from existing policies, again on the same day that we went public with it, and we always give them a date to answer by, and universities sometimes just don't take us up on this. We're serious. We want to engage in a dialogue about this.
So what's your next step on this case?
Well, right now it's actually been receiving a lot of media, and we're going to continue to press it through the media. And we actually just sent them a letter making, in my opinion, some pretty obvious arguments. Because There was some very knee-jerk sort of response that from one professor saying that, oh, this is only essentially a right-wing concern, and I think that's ludicrous. I mean, we finished off our second letter to Teachers College by making a very simple and humane point that great teachers come in all shapes and sizes from all backgrounds and beliefs, and that let Teachers College policies reflect this reality.
You're reading from the text, are you not?
Yep, and that's just, and I mean, I think that's just a basic moral stance that unless you're omniscient or omnipotent, you should not be telling people what their internal beliefs need to be in order to be a good person, because you don't know.
Well, of course, that's elementary.
Yeah.
It's utterly
elementary. And it's amazing that we have to explain this stuff.
Yeah. I guess the defense of freedom requires constant vigilance.
Absolutely. And it is a shame how often you have to bring back first principles, how often you have to explain. These students at Columbia, the ones who went after Gilchrist, when they were being criticized on the air, one of them accused Sean Hannity of verbal harassment because he was criticizing them.
Is it possible that this disposition towards dispositional analysis of your students, which is really essentially checking them out as to whether they've got the properly liberal leftist orientation. Though you could have equally demanding dispositional analysis in some fundamentalist-based colleges where you'd expect something quite different.
Right.
I'm fully aware of that. But is it possible that there are some whole disciplines, in the sense of intellectual disciplines, which are contaminated by this sort of thing?
Absolutely. So social work and teachers' education are the places where we've seen the most problems with these, where essentially universities have been very clear that you have to have the following, in some cases, the following points of view, you're not welcome. And that's one of the teachers' college has come back with essentially two rather weak arguments. One that essentially amounts to, we don't really mean it, we don't enforce it as a political litmus test. And as we explained in our response, it's written as a political litmus test, and if you don't mean it, it shouldn't be your policy.
Fascinating and very worrying, in fact. Some commercials a bit overdue. We turn to them and then directly back to Greg Lukianoff. And we return to Greg Lukianoff. 591-7200 is where you reach us, whether you're a student, professor, administrator, concerned parent, or what have you. 591-7200, some lines are available. Get your calls in quickly. We'd love to hear from you. And a report from your institution of reference, so to speak. And here is the first. Hello, you're on the air.
Well, hello, Milton. Boy, I'm none of the above, although I like to just call myself taxpayer.
Yes, sir.
And I'd like to ask Fire Chief Greg there, first of all, a great site, even though I have to admit there is no spotlight on my alma mater, University of Hawaii at Manoa. So if you're ever looking for somebody to do a little campus watch and have anything in the funds for a little air flight and travel there, I'm your guy.
Sounds great.
Well, here's my question. We've talked about universities in terms of those with a flagrant disregard for free speech. Mm-hmm. How about, in your opinion, who are some professors who are very notable for their intolerance for free speech, whether it's advocacy of speech codes, whether it's more of free speech for me but not for thee? What would be your standard for that?
See, that brings something to my mind. We were talking about Columbia before. Do I have this correct? There was a guy in their Middle Eastern studies program who refused to allow an Israeli student to be in his class.
That was the statement that he actually made, that you're not allowed to make certain arguments in his class, and he was actually chastised for that, at least after tremendous national pressure on Columbia.
But the guy had worked in the Israeli Defense Forces, I think, and he was ruled out of the classroom by this particular professor.
Well, there were a number of different incidents. One with the Israeli Defense Force, I believe, actually took place outside of the class, but certainly there's been there's been some real serious abuses that have been at least encouraged by university professors, like the Northern Kentucky University case. In a sign of progress, the professor in the Northern Kentucky University case, who, if you weren't listening earlier, who led her students or encouraged her students to destroy a pro-life display, to quote-unquote exercise their free speech rights to destroy a pro-life display, was actually punished by the university. Now, believe it or not, that's progress. I think it was UMass Amherst, when there was a number of conservative newspapers destroyed maybe five or 6 years ago, an administrator defended it by saying that, well, you can't really steal a free newspaper, rather than saying what they should have said is that this is mob censorship. This is completely inconsistent with the
That's
free
an
society.
Incident that has happened again and again on American campuses.
Censorship, newspaper theft is a plague, and it shows that university students, and I believe that they're actually learning their lessons, they're taking the lead in a lot of cases from their professors who were teaching them their, you know.
It's worth noting that sometimes students are the most intolerant bunch on the campus.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. No doubt about it. And there was, I finished off my Senate testimony back in 2003 by talking about an incident where students actually gathered up newspapers and burned them. And just to think how chilling that is, that we're teaching the next generations of leaders that it's okay to engage in practical book burnings.
All of this began years ago at a place that I used to teach at, Dartmouth College. When some bright young people, many of whom have gone on to be quite prominent public commentators, started something called the Dartmouth Review, which was a conservative newspaper. And that offended many of the faculty and many among the students. And that paper was regularly distributed freely, but picked up and destroyed.
Absolutely.
And the administration would do nothing about it.
Well, I think one of the great examples of how far up this goes was in Berkeley, when the mayor of Berkeley actually was caught throwing out copies of a student newspaper that endorsed his opponent. And it's amazing. He was reelected, and after he was, he decided to pass a newspaper theft ban for the city of Berkeley, which is just amazing on so many different levels.
Our thanks to the caller, and let's go to another on 591-7200. Good evening. You're on the air.
Good evening, Dr. Rosenberg and guest. Thank you for the interesting show and appreciate it. You have been talking most of the program about the quote-unquote political correctness movement and its effect on the academic world in terms of individual rights on campus. I'd like to hear the commentary and insight that the guest would have regarding what he feels would be the both benefits and also the downsides of the quote-unquote academic freedom movement, which has recently been headed up by Mr. David Horowitz. Could you just give us some context and insight as to what you feel some aspects of that particular movement would be if it got going, some
that's very
positive
good.
Negatives?
Yeah, let's make clear. Horowitz has been pushing what he calls an academic bill of rights, and he's got a number of state legislatures to sort of voted in.
Right. Well, there's the thing about the Academic Bill of Rights is there's been actually many different versions of it, and some of them are essentially restatements of the 1941 American Association of University Professors statement, which is a very clear statement saying that you shouldn't evaluate students on their political beliefs, that that professors shouldn't introduce material that has nothing to do with their class into their classrooms. And this is, you know, pretty standard at all universities. However, there have been other versions of it that that state legislatures have considered, none of which have passed to my knowledge, that try to ban quote-unquote indoctrination. Now, again, back in my 2003 Senate testimony, I pointed out that particularly at a public college, if you had a vague and overbroad rule like trying to ban indoctrination, that would never pass constitutional muster because it would turn into the, it would devolve into this constant fight of people saying, you indoctrinated me, I indoctrinated you. And it would really lead to a great decay in the quality of discussion in the academy. There was one version of it that was initially spawned by the person was originally citing the Academic Bill of Rights, and I think this was out in Arizona. Where it showed sort of the danger of misunderstanding some of these principles, and I believe they tried to pass it where essentially students would have a veto right over learning about books that offended them, and that's the thing is a right of private conscience misunderstood starts looking an awful lot like a right not to be offended. Now, David Horowitz himself actually even disowned this particular policy as just being absurd and unmanageable and not part of the ABOR.
You're for the comment, sir.
I think that was pretty much about it. I'd like to pose one hypothetical scenario to your guest. You mentioned earlier in the program that there's a kind of a contractual obligation between a student and a university in terms of what a student expects at a university. In other words, specifically free speech, et cetera. And you use the parallel of Harvard with people giving to Harvard and Harvard expressing itself as a bastion of free speech. I'd just like to give the guest a scenario which, although hypothetical, could very well manifest itself. Supposing for a moment that a university says that students have a right to be exposed to multiple points of view on a certain issue. Let's suppose, for instance, that let's say a teacher was teaching a class about just going to pick an issue of the Holocaust. Let's say, what would be your What would be your position then if that professor then gave equal time to teaching, for example, on one hand about the Holocaust, and in second, and on the other hand, teaching about Holocaust denial, not just about Holocaust denial as a something which comes up, et cetera, but actually giving it equal weight, equal credibility, for instance, as a quote-unquote alternate point of view? How would your organization basically take that up as something to where if I'm a student taking a course, I expect to be basically taught the facts and given some clarity and insight by the professor on an academic subject, not exposed to quote-unquote all points of view.
In your hypothetical, who's deciding that, that he has to cover quote-unquote all points of view? Is it the is the university who's deciding it, or is he, or is the professor himself deciding
it? I guess I kind of mixed myself up there.
Yeah.
all points of view in the second case and several.
Well, you're really posing the situation in which the teacher is a believer in Holocaust denial, believes that the Holocaust didn't happen, and he's conveying that view to his students.
Exactly.
That's the strongest form of that case.
Absolutely. Yeah. And that's something that I oftentimes get presented as sort of the gotcha sort of question. It's like, oh, surely you don't believe that, that a professor can talk about something as offensive as Holocaust denial. Well, I know a thing or two about the quote-unquote scholarship of Holocaust denial, and it's what's to be afraid of?
It's laughable.
It's laughable. I mean, like, what is it, that theory that there was a coincidental yellow fever epidemic at the same time that just happened to be.
A similar thing we get these days is those rather odd people who believe in another sinister scenario, namely that 9/11 didn't really happen or was staged by the American government.
Right, and that's one of the things that we've been very clear on. It is defending free speech is defending a principle.
There's a fellow up there in Wisconsin who was teaching that 9/11 conspiracy theory.
Barrett.
And that became a public issue, did it not?
And that was a very interesting case about what academic freedom actually means. And I feel like University of Wisconsin, I really wish University of Wisconsin would get better counsel because they seem to bungle legal issues all
what
the time.
What did they do in that one?
In that one, they seemed to screw up on every turn. They had a professor who wanted to have in his class about Islam and the West an entire week on 9/11 conspiracy theories. Now, there are three different levels of academic freedom. The institution has academic freedom to decide what will be taught. The professor decides how it can be taught. And students have their own academic freedom rights, including the right to principally dissent. When the professor was saying that he was going to have this section in his Islamic history class, the university initially started investigating him for his political opinions, which they shouldn't be doing. He shouldn't be investigating, particularly for his outside political statements. That's inappropriate. And even though that may mean that sometimes, you know, weird opinions are sustained over on the whole, it's a good thing to maintain that principle. Then they came back and said he absolutely can teach about 9/11 and his Islam in the West class, but if you understand academic freedom, they would actually have the right to say, well, it doesn't really seem exactly a good use of our time to have an entire week of because Islam in the West is a kind of big topic. You don't necessarily have to spend a week to talk about 9/11 conspiracy theories. But then, after they said that publicly, which sort of bungled the idea of academic freedom, they come out and publicly criticize him for, on his own time, talking about 9/11 conspiracy theories. So they got things exactly backwards.
He was, though, a believer in the 9/11
yes,
conspiracy
he is, yeah.
theory, which is what got them upset.
Right. Absolutely. And that's one of the things that we say, like, Fire, for example, defended the free speech rights of Ward Churchill, not the academic misconduct, although we were very clear that he deserved due process rights like everybody. But, you know, as we said before, and we'll say it again, is that we have much more to fear from the erosion of academic freedom of the Bill of Rights than we do from the weird ideas of any particular individual.
Our thanks to the caller. And you just used a name that we hadn't yet introduced tonight, Ward Churchill.
Yep.
It's a case we haven't discussed tonight, though many of our listeners may be somewhat aware of it. Mm-hmm. There's a man who, by my measure, just judging another public academic, is odious at almost every possible, on every possible dimension.
He's hard to like.
He's hard to like.
Absolutely. And
and there's been a clamor for the governor of Colorado, because this fellow teaches at the University of Colorado, to fire him from that faculty.
Right. Well, and we got involved in that, and of course it wasn't a very popular case, but and he said, I mean, I'm a born New Yorker. My sister worked in the World Trade Center until 3 months before it. I thought his opinions on basically saying that
he said we deserve what we got.
Pretty much, yeah. Was
and the people who were killed there were all his quote
little Eichmanns.
Little Eichmanns.
Right. So you know, I wrote that letter and I actually got more personal in it than I usually do, and I explained about my personal relationship and the fact that I was writing from New York at the time, but essentially saying that it is much more important to defend the Bill of Rights than to allow someone's opinions cause us to erode the concepts like academic freedom and free speech. What ended up happening was that, and also, frankly, with my lawyer hat on, it wasn't a close call whether or not he had the right to do that. The law is very clear, so even if you could come up with some rationale, the law would not be on your side. But one of the kind of silly arguments that defenders of Ward Church were making was, well, since this investigation was completely started because of opinions, now if they find that he's done anything actually, if he's actually done anything wrong, it should not be held against him. And we very clearly said no, because if you've actually done something wrong in the past, committed academic misconduct, the fact that you're currently being punished for free speech doesn't somehow magically inoculate
what,
you.
Well, all he did was plagiarize apparently some articles and make up a curriculum vitae which isn't completely
right.
accurate, and to find himself as an Indian when the Indian tribe he claims to belong to says he's no Indian.
Yeah, the Colorado Mountain News did a research on that, and as best they could tell, he had not a drop going. I mean, for goodness sakes, his name is Ward Churchill. Can you have a more...
Well, you could be a 1/60th Indian.
I guess so, but it turns out he's 100% Ward Churchill.
We pause for an update, rather just for a round of commercials. And my quite special guest is Greg Lukianoff, president of the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education. And here is the next caller. Good evening.
Good evening. I'm from the Conservative Alliance at DePaul University here in Chicago. And I'm sure Greg can attest that we have dealt with many free speech issues at DePaul.
DePaul's an overachiever.
A basket case, as you said, on Hannity and Colmes.
Yes, I did.
But the main thing that I remember you said a couple minutes ago, you talked about if you are not offended at a university, you need to go get your money back.
Mm-hmm.
The problem with the left at DePaul is that the most offensive people at DePaul are arguing for restrictions of free speech. They are arguing to be protected from offensive speech.
What's the case, or what are the details of that?
Well, for instance, DePaul has a free speech policy, which is an anti-discriminatory policy right now. And in it, it talks about certain things that are disallowed. And one of them is offensive innuendo, which is a completely subjective term, which basically allows for every human being in the university, one person or a group of three people, to decide what is offensive and therefore disallow that speech.
So if I were a faculty member at DePaul and I said, and I might have been, except I was at the University of Chicago, but if I took an appointment at DePaul in my dotage and said to a fellow faculty member, who had just given some cockeyed theory, if I said to him, you're really rather dim, aren't you?
Yeah.
That could be a violation of the code?
Yeah, that's correct. You could file a you're being discriminated against because he was offensive towards you.
Well, I was offensive towards him. I said, you're rather dim.
Oh, okay.
I'm saying you're rather dumb.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then he could file a complaint and say that, well, you were being offensive towards him.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well,
Not to deviate too much, but I just have to tell the story. This is actually something that happened right when I started at FIRE, you know, First Amendment specialized lawyer, and I got a call from a friend who's probably the most saintly person I've ever known in my life, and he is brought up on sexual harassment charges because he worked with emotionally disturbed kids, and he had a sign on his door saying that you're now entering an appropriate zone, and a way of warning kids, like, in my classroom you'll behave well. He'd previously told two female teachers that he didn't think they were very good teachers. They brought him up on sexual harassment charges, and I've read their complaint. It actually, first of all, they spelled sexist wrong. They spelled it sexiest. Next, they spelled hostile environment as if the hostel you stay in, you know, when you go traveling abroad.
Oh my.
And their argument was that by having that sign up, you're implying that everywhere outside of your classroom is an inappropriate zone. That was actually the argument. So, yeah, these sort of nonsensical applications are real. They happen.
Now, zeroing in on DePaul, the main case there at the moment is the so-called Cloche case. Is that right?
That's correct.
Would you review for us what that is?
Well, that's the best example of political correctness invading DePaul University. Basically, what happened is Professor Tom Klocek had an argument or a debate of some sort with Palestinian students who were distributing anti-Israeli literature, and he presented the pro-Israeli argument.
Was this in a classroom?
No, this was at a extracurricular student involvement fair, is what they call them.
Uh-huh.
And he had an argument with them, and he presented the pro-Israeli argument, and basically these Palestinian students were offended by the pro-Israeli argument, and they filed a complaint with the university, mm-hmm. and the university, you know, said, yeah, if you're offended, you know, we need to protect you, we need to take care of your feelings. And therefore this professor was offensive and he has no right to mm-hmm. to teach at DePaul anymore.
And well, they ruled him out as an adjunct member of the faculty. He's mm-hmm. not tenured, we know that.
Mm-hmm.
But then they required him to kind of go get some counseling, and if he were going to teach again, they would have to monitor his teaching. Wasn't
yep.
that
mm-hmm.
the weren't those the conditions they put to him?
That's correct. And initially he was they put forward different conditions at different times. Initially he was open to the first conditions, and the second conditions about having being monitored in class, he rejected those, and he said, you know what, this is just censorship and you know, ridiculous behavior by this supposedly Catholic university.
Now, Greg, was that considered actionable by
oh yeah,
fire.
We got involved in it mainly for the due process concerns because this is a 15-year career ended without any due process, and that's pretty remarkable. That potentially if you have a mm-hmm. confrontation with students and it's the worst imaginable.
I might say right now I want to do a program on this. Some
mm-hmm.
of the people from DePaul approached me, and I said yes, I'll do it if we can get representatives of the administration.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's the problem. They don't want to participate.
They
don't want to participate.
They completely blocked me off. They wouldn't talk to me.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
One woman about third or fourth down the line in their PR department said, we have nothing to say and nobody will come on your program.
Mm-hmm. And it's a great example of the abuse of social justice because, and that's one of the things, you know, as I was saying, our concern about terms like social justice being abused is not hypothetical.
Yeah.
In the past year, we've seen a good, you know, six different examples, and Klocek is one of them, where they actually did cite the idea of his lack of commitment to, quote-unquote, this nebulous term of social
yeah.
justice as
they
being
don't
one
know
of the
what
reasons why they ended his career.
Well, what's happening at the university? I gather you and people like you are making representations to the administration, are you not?
That's correct. And we've, as students, even been shut down on numerous occasions trying to test this policy of offensive innuendo, and they've shut us down on numerous occasions.
Shut down what exactly?
Well, Greg can attest to the first one. Ward Churchill had come to DePaul University,
uh-huh.
And we had wanted to post flyers detailing what Ward Churchill has said in the past and
uh-huh.
kind of giving people the opposing viewpoint that the university wasn't giving. And they told us that we weren't allowed to post posters because they were propaganda.
Yeah, they came up with a new policy in which they and they added this to the existing policy.
De facto policy.
Well, they actually added the language saying we don't allow propaganda at the university.
Let me say to the caller, we've got some newscast coming at this instant. If you want to hang in there for a bit,
I'd be happy to.
We might continue this a bit more after we go to the newsroom for a full update from Paula Cooper. And once again, our caller from DePaul. I gather you are a student, sir.
I am. I'm a sophomore.
You're an undergraduate student.
That's correct.
So, well, anything else you want to tell us? Go ahead. Or anything you want to put to Greg Lukianov?
Well, basically, the question that I have, and going through this process right now, we're going through a kind of a task force of deciding, you know, what a free speech policy should be at DePaul. And many have argued, including myself, that a free speech policy should basically be no policy. You shouldn't have any, very little restrictions, if any. And the problem that exists, and going back to what I first talked about, is why do these people that are on the left, they especially should be arguing for no restrictions, yet they're arguing for restrictions and saying, well, if you're offensive, I don't want to hear you speak. When, in fact, they are the most offensive people. You know, they're advocating flag burning and the vagina monologues and things like that. I mean, obscene things, and in fact, they don't realize that it's a double road.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that, there's a tremendous double standard that I've just become all too familiar with on college campuses, and I think one of the kind of like almost comical versions of this was down at Indian River College down in Florida, and this is a commuter college with something like 45,000 students. They wouldn't let the campus Christian group show the Passion of the Christ. And they said that they weren't going to allow them to show the Passion of the Christ because it was R-rated. Now, first of all, for a group that's very concerned about the infantilization of adult students, that was not the argument to make to us. But we did our homework. And at the same time that they were saying that the Christian students couldn't show the most popular foreign language film that's ever been released, I think, is actually it's The Distinction of the Passion of the Christ, as far as like in sales. They were showing other R-rated movies, sponsoring the showing of an R-rated documentary, but also hosting a skit called, I would want to be at least a little discreet sometimes, Effing for Jesus, which was all about masturbating to an image of to a crucifix. Now, we're serious about our defending everybody, and we came out very clearly. It's like, yeah, you should allow adult students to have that skit. But to turn around and allow that skit and then ban The Passion of the Christ for Christian students, that's just, are you kidding me?
Yeah. Well, the problem with that was, I assume, was that a public university?
It was a public university, yeah.
There comes a difference when you're dealing with, especially DePaul, a Catholic university, a private university that is not bound by the First Amendment. But that's a whole other can of worms.
Sure.
But I'd like to thank Greg here for helping us here at DePaul, and just a message to all students being conservative, especially being oppressed. You have a place to go to and fire, and they will help you. So.
Well, we thank you for the call.
Thank you very much.
Interesting update indeed. You do have a place to go to regarding fire, and I declare and reveal my own interest. I am not a totally neutral party. I am, in fact, and have been long before we planned this program, a member of the Board of Advisors of Fire. I became very enthusiastic for the project when Coors and his partner, Silverglate, appeared on this program talking about the book which got the whole thing started. And that was back in 1999,
yeah.
Or thereabouts. We pause for the usual reasons and then directly back to your calls and or emails. We've got calls, but I don't see too much by way of email. If you are so disposed to email us, the address, again, extension 720 at tribune.com. And for phones, of course, it's 591-7200. And directly back to Greg Lukianoff. Now then, I want to read you an email that has come in from Milwaukee, one assumes. This correspondent says, the example on your show, I should say, he identifies himself as a student at the Marquette University Law School. And he says, the example on your show earlier this evening regarding the PhD student at Marquette posting a Dave Barry quote is just one of many such examples at Marquette. In the recent past year, a Marquette student in the School of Dentistry was suspended for posting on his personal non-Marquette-sponsored web blog an honest opinion on the quality of teaching by one of his professors. He knocked one of his professors on his own personal blog, obviously, and he was suspended for that. Going on. Additionally, the advisor of the student newspaper was, quote, fired, end quote, in the recent past for allowing the newspaper staff too much latitude in the comments that were allowed on the editorial page, especially in regards to the university's use of student funds and the controversy over the, quote, Warriors mascot. You may know what that is. I don't.
I don't. I assume it's an Indian mascot.
Yeah.
That's where a lot of the controversy.
Other than a brief mention of the Dave Barry quote controversy last spring, the student newspaper has been devoid of comment, proving that censorship really does work.
Wow. Oh, please contact FIRE. We don't like to let that stand, and we're certainly not going to allow that to go without a fight. I mean, and that's one of the things that people need to understand about FIRE is if we can actually prove something, we go to bat just pretty much every time.
I wonder what happens when college administrators get together in their conventions. What do they say off in the corner of the bar about FIRE?
Oh, well, I don't know. They don't invite me to say that. Definitely, I've discovered that, you know, some administrators really do believe in free speech, and they've been quietly horrified. But I definitely, when I go to these conventions, I'm not exactly the most popular guy in the room.
You do go and make presentations.
You bet. And it's scary, and it's a hostile audience sometimes. But over the years, they've become increasingly aware of the fact that I'm not going anywhere.
When you say hostile, what counterarguments do they offer?
Occasionally, the rawest kind, that essentially that we will not tolerate offensive or backward-thinking speech. That this is a crusade against offensive or insensitive opinions, and that I and that essentially, without recognizing this is what they're saying, is that I am the arbiter of propriety, and I know what people should say and they shouldn't say. And the interesting thing is engaging them in dialogue about this. Sometimes it's as if they've never, some of them have never heard any of these concepts before, and it's actually been very productive to go to some of these conferences every year, because you do find that some of them do actually understand the concepts. You find some of them have completely reared in an atmosphere where they think the worst thing that can happen to a student or anybody else is that they should be offended, particularly if it's a religiously orthodox point of view, or if it's a conservative point of view, or gasp if the university if somebody makes fun of some of the values of the university.
I remember one funny case, speaking of religion. This occurred up at Tufts, and I think you guys had a hand in it. It goes back a number of years. There was a student group who were a Christian, I think a fundamentalist Christian group.
Right.
And somebody showed up who wanted to join the group and wanted to run for the presidency, except he was not a Christian, and I believe he was also homosexual, which violated the tenets of the group itself, there being sort of orthodox or fundamentalist Christians. And they said, no, you can't be a member. And for that, they were disestablished by the administration. They were kicked off, didn't get student funds, I guess, student opinion.
Well, they're de-recognized entirely.
They were delegitimated, de-recognized. And you took up that case, didn't you?
That was actually just slightly before my time, and David French, who was just a cooperating lawyer at the time, that was the first case he was involved with FIRE about. And it's one of these it's another concept that people I feel like universities are quite thick on.
They got them reinstated.
Yes.
Yeah. In this case, by pointing out they were violating the law.
Exactly. And freedom of association, I mean, just having to point out that freedom of association doesn't mean anything if you can't, quote unquote, discriminate on the basis of belief.
Yeah.
That's not discrimination. That's freedom of association.
The child's definition of a club is to keep people out.
Yeah, exactly. And so we've seen so many of these cases, and I definitely understand how people, and I sympathize that people are like, this is, you know, I don't agree with their opinion on sexual morality. Well, then don't join the club. They think this is true. You don't have the right to tell them that they're not allowed to have that point of view. And, of course, they exclude people who don't subscribe to their beliefs.
Back to the phones. 591-7200. Good evening. Hello, are you there?
Yes, sir.
Go ahead, please.
I have a bachelor's and doctor's from a public university here in Illinois. And with respect to the previous caller, I don't believe that Chicago, Northwestern, DePaul, or Loyola are really in the same category as the public universities with regard to free speech or academic freedom. I would like to know what the speaker's opinions are of the present state of academic freedom and public and free speech are at the public universities, University of Illinois, Champaign-Urbana, and the teachers' colleges at Eastern, Northern, Western, and Southern, and I think at Illinois Normal.
I just want to make sure that I understand what you're saying. Are you saying that you think things are worse at the public colleges in Illinois, or
no?
You're saying that it's an overall better situation.
I think they have completely different situations. I think private universities, particularly those supported by religious orders, are in a different category than state-funded universities, particularly our university at Champaign-Urbana, which is a major university.
Right.
And I don't think that you can criticize that. I see things going on at DePaul that are religiously based and have totally... there's one particular professor who deals a great deal in the Jesus seminar and so forth. You know, this doesn't have anything to do with, in my opinion, this is a separate issue from free speech and the faculty freedom at, for example, Illinois Normal or University of Illinois.
Okay. Well,
is that fair? Do I make myself clear? clear.
No, I understand. We have had some pretty serious abuses at Illinois colleges, though. And I mean, one of the worst ones that I've seen, and a very raw incident of censorship, is a public college at Illinois, which led to a terrible, terrible legal decision, which is Governor State University, where a dean, and this was just raw in the sense that the university was sick of a student, Margaret Hostie, and her paper of criticizing the university, and a dean decided to demand that the printer of the newspaper not be allowed to print anymore until she was granted the right to of prior review. This was a pretty brazen violation of free speech rights, and two lower court decisions actually recognized this. Unfortunately, there was a Court of Appeals decision that completely misconstrued the idea of student fees and actually found that this was not apparently a serious enough violation. So there have been some serious abuses in Illinois.
Our thanks to the caller, and we pause very briefly for a last round of messages, then back to your calls on 591-7200. It does occur to me, Greg, I should put a very basic question. I carry on this program constantly, I've done so for years, about the deteriorating quality of the education that is given in American institutions of higher learning. A standard speech that I give when I'm asked to come out of the studio and address some group is the lowering of higher education. Deeply burdens and preoccupies me. Is there any connection between the quality of education and the problems that we're discussing?
It's one of the things, we don't get too much into the quality of education, but as a personal theory, the fact that I see such gross misunderstandings of basic theories, basic civics lessons, it does lead me to believe that there are aspects, basic fundamental aspects of education that students simply aren't receiving. Like the idea that they can actually believe that it's verbal harassment for someone to strongly disagree with them, that they believe that they have a free speech right to destroy a protest or disrupt someone else's protest. The fact that, in Washington State University, administrators actually organized students to disrupt a play that they didn't like and then sort of shrugged their shoulders and said, well, this is a legitimate exercise of free speech to disrupt a play. Given how poorly students seem to understand these basic concepts, I have to believe that they're simply not learning them.
We go back to the phones. A few quick final calls. Here is the next. Hello, you're on the air.
Hi, Milt. How are you doing today?
All right, sir.
Mine is a little different from the other callers. In 1999, I was a senior at Chicago State University, where I was a part of a radio station that's an in-house radio station that's only played in student common areas. And at the time, Stone Cold Steve Austin, the wrestler, was very popular, so we had a student on air who would do a wrestling show with a couple of people there, and he would just say what Steve Austin would say, the hell yeah. So we had students that were on the radio station that did not want him to say it, so I kind of, took it upon myself to say, well, this is ridiculous that he can't say this when we have a person who's doing Bible verses and Revelations, and I'm sure the word hell is somewhere in there.
He couldn't just say hell yeah?
Exactly.
That's amazing.
Well, who brought pressure on you? What did they?
The students initially started it, but I went to the faculty. They wouldn't even stop the students from doing it. It was incredible. I cannot believe that something as simple as hell yeah.
That's ridiculous.
So you were ordered not to say that on the air.
We were ordered. I didn't stop doing it. I took it on for him because they were going to put him off the air. I wound up getting put off the air. I wish that I knew fire had existed, but I was a senior. I was getting ready to graduate.
We'd be
but
happy
I couldn't
to have involved kids like that.
I could not believe that students.
I may have to test that out and say hell yeah three or four times on this program and see what the guys at the front office will do. We go quickly to another caller, 591-7200, and you are on the air. Good evening. Yes, sir.
Yeah, well, this is, I had a situation at a large junior college in the area, and I brought October 2nd was Mahatma Gandhi's birthday, and he was a champion of humane farming. And I took posters in about how animals are slaughtered today, and I had them okayed, the office okayed them and everything, and they put them up. And I came back a couple of weeks, well, I assume they put them up, they told me they did. I came back a couple of weeks later to look to see them, and none of them hardly were up. So I contacted the office and asked about it, and the fellow said, well, I'll, check into it and see what happened. That fellow was ahead of this. So I called him back a couple of days later, and what he said was that the one poster was it said it's a filthy business, they couldn't do it without you, and it showed how they slaughtered a cow. And he was hanging from the ceiling by his back leg, and he had a guy there slitting his throat, you know, and you saw the blood come out.
Mm-hmm.
And he said that, you know, evidently what happened, that what students did was they didn't like the posters, they marked them up, and they tore them up in that, so they had to take them down. Mm-hmm. So I was wondering, what is the situation in something like that?
Well, it really is remarkable the number of restrictions that universities put on posting rights, and actually the fact that you had to get it pre-approved to me is kind of a sign of the times too, and we've seen certainly a number of cases where people making basic political statements.
You know, that reminds me of something. Our thanks to that caller. That really has bothered me when I've read about it, the establishment in various universities on various campuses of so-called free speech zones, meaning you can go here to talk.
Absolutely.
And to relate to people and argue with them, but you can't do it elsewhere on campus.
Texas Tech University, I'll just say it as quickly as I can. I've been so opposed to free speech zones. They're so ridiculous. Texas Tech University, a school of 28,000 students, when we first got involved there, and it was on behalf of students protesting the war, had one 20-foot-wide gazebo as the lone, quote-unquote, free speech zone on campus, which included where you could hand out newspapers, where you could hand out flyers. And, you know, I always love saying this, but it's true. My friend from MIT, who graduated with a math degree from there, I had him do the dimensional analysis of this, do the math on it. And if all 28,000 students wanted to exercise their free speech rights at once, you'd have to crush them down to the density of uranium-238. Mm. And it's funny, because I said, oh, that's very funny. He's like, no, I'm serious. You really would have to actually crush them down to the density of uranium-238.
There's so much more that could be said as one continued a total survey of violations of the basic standards that anchor democracy,
mm-hmm.
that is the standards of free speech and free thought, but the violation of those standards on American campuses. But that whole problem will be monitored from here to eternity by the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, whose president, Greg Lukianoff, has been our guest tonight.